in preparing to talk today, I basically, you know, always find myself wanting to talk with anyone I come to talk with about what's on the edge for me. And maybe it's because what I'm interested in, and I'm basically ultimately just selfish. But also I feel like it is a sort of a vulnerable place to speak from. And I think it works best when I speak from there. So very salient in my life is that recently I have lost two great teachers. A year and a half ago, Darlene Cohen, and a few weeks ago, Catherine Thanis. And I also lost two great friends in that same time frame, two dogs, Lucy, and my very best friend in the world, my little dog, Faith, who was with me for 16 years, who died. So Lucy died 1 month after Darlene, and I accused Darlene of taking my dachshund. And Faith died 1 month before Catherine to prepare, you know, the way. So dachshunds are a very loyal and very excellent breed, and they showed that to me. So in each case, I was called by duty, because they were my animals, or by community, to care for the physical remains of the one who passed. You know, we leave behind our physical remains when we leave the earth. And someone cares for those in some way. And culture and religious practice and so on determine kind of how we do that. But what this has led me to in terms of practice is to ask myself, what is this body? You know, what is this vessel that we are and are not? On a conventional marketplace level, taking care of these two great women I have learned a lot about death, about the death industry, actually. And there is an entire industry around death, which we don't usually know very much about until we're in it. And by then, it's too late to do anything other than just engage this industry, this death industry that we have in this culture. And what I've learned is that for the most part, the engagement of that death industry is a waste of resources and does not really honor the vessel or those who love the person. And so I have really seen now on two occasions with, and even with my animals, that we can care for our own. We can care for our own. That the vast majority of the things, in fact, all of the things that are done by the death industry, other than cremation or actual interment, can be done by us right here in this room for one another. We don't need anything other than us right here in this room to care for any one of us right here in this room who might need that kind of care. And so I'm starting to talk about that. For two reasons. One is because it is a terrible waste that we spend, you know, I think with Catherine, we employed a mortuary because I didn't know what was going on, and that's what we did, and as a signature for $10,000 just to engage them, and then another, an additional fee for everything on top of that. So the $10,000 is the base fee, and then $2,000 for the ride from the home to the coroner, and about $1,500 for the ride from, you know, here and there and over to the crematory, which is their crematory, another $1,000, you know. And before you know it, you know, $15,000. I don't know what the real number was for Catherine, but I'm just saying that that it's a tremendous use of resources that really don't need to be used that way. But that's not the most important reason. The reason I'm talking about this is to send the message that the deepest practice I have experienced has been in the care of the vessel. And when we remove it off to someone else to care for it, to be with it, to hold it, to dress it, to bathe it, we give that away. We give away an opportunity for the kind of intimacy we cannot have with another person, except when the person has left the vessel. And what we have is the vessel to care for. It's very, very, it's an experience like no other, caring for the vessel after death, and very intimate and deep, and always a teaching until the very last push into the retort at the crematory. So I think we deny ourselves that practice opportunity when we give the remains over. And I felt that way about my dog as well, Faith. When she died, she'd been with me 16 years. I did not want to give her remains over to another person to care for her. So I sewed a shroud for my little 7-pound wonder dog. And I wrapped her in her shroud and I placed her on my altar. And I offered offerings. And I did the 108 bells for my little friend, and I buried her in my front yard. And someone came from Zen Center to dig the hole, and I was so happy because the size of the dog was clearly underestimated. So we had to enlarge the hole, which I think very fitting, my little 7-pound wonder dog. So this vessel here, it's very beautiful. And one of the things I actually love about being at Jikoji and coming to Jikoji is the care you take of the Dharma vessel here. And I see it everywhere. I was sitting here looking at this little setup here. So beautiful. How this little podium built just for this right here, just to serve right here, sits here in perfect concert with this beautiful little lectern, strictly made for it, I believe. They look like they were made for each other. Such care taken in this connection here, this little corner here, such care taken here of the Dharma vessel. And this, to me, reflects the care you take in your hearts and in your minds with your practice. And we see it here, and we see it in how you fold your robe or how you put your shoes outside the door. It's everywhere. And it's striking here. In the moss over here with no leaves, you know, you see it there. People have cared for that spot. So I think it's really a beautiful caring for the Dharma vessel. And that to me is exactly the same as what we do when we care for the body of someone who has passed. The body needs a great deal of care and adjustment before when it is alive. And you can note that in Zazen, how much, even in 40 minutes or 30 minutes of sitting, how much care and adjustment and attention the body needs. And it also needs a lot of care and adjustment after death. So, you know, things happen when the body dies. For example, the mouth falls open. You don't have muscle tone. So for a little while, there's a hardening of muscle that takes place. And then that lasts a couple hours, and then it goes away. Mouth falls, sometimes the eyes open and so on. So how do we work with that when we are here with our loved one? We bring ourselves totally to this. We bring ourselves totally to the care of the body, alive or dead. It matters not. We bring ourselves totally to the care of ourselves before death, and of one another after death. This I believe is actually our practice and a perfect opportunity to bring it forth. Ours is a body practice, and we talk about the body in practice and how important how we can't practice without the body. This is a body practice, and all of the activity of the universe is actually visible in this body. So Dogen talks about the entire universe is the human body. So we can ask ourselves, what do I exclude from this? What do I think is not part of this? Right? Because our teaching is that the entire universe is this. And I think we don't even have to go outside the skin to reveal and to see that the universal activity is playing out right within this vessel. Birth, conditioned lifespan, which all phenomena is characterized by, and death, movement, stillness, pain, pleasure, heat, cold, temperature change, something that smells good and something that smells bad, because that's all just our story about the thing. It has nothing to do with the thing, the smell. Inhaling, exhaling, nourishing, and eliminating. These are all universal activity. And if you are in nature, which you are here at Jikoji, you live in it, you see that all the time. You see all the functions of the body and all universal activity in each of those and in all of those. So the body is universal activity. And we can say the body of the earth, the body of the tree, the body of the bush, the body of practice, this body, universal activity. It's all there, actually. And Dogen, in Undivided Activity, said, to study the way with the body, this means to study the way with your own body. It is to study the way using this lump of red meat. That's what Dogen says. So we don't get to pick the body that we bring. I mean, maybe there are people who think we did pick it, but... You know, I have to practice. I learned this along. This was probably the most significant thing that happened a long time ago for me in practice. It was a watershed for me in my practice, was realizing. So I think I sat for a long time wishing I had somebody else's body, pretty much anybody else's body. You know, anybody that could sit still on a cushion looking at the wall, you know, immobile, looking perfectly like Buddha, I wished for that body. And I would sit next to that person longing for that body. And be crying the fact that I have this body. And then we would get up to bow, and I'd be all moving the mat all over the floor, and I, you know, can't keep anything, you know, and moving forward when I'm bowing. And I'd watch these people who would come in and float in, you know, and bow almost without touching the floor, you know. I would just wish for that body. And what somehow at some point, through probably some pretty skillful teaching, I got, but no, if I'm going to do this, if Beata is going to practice, it's going to be in this body. And then Dogen says, with this lump of red meat. I don't get to pick Doug's tall, thin, beautiful, mobile, you know, flexible body. Or Michael's elegant, you know, embodied, right? This body, right? And probably if Michael were giving this, he could talk about his lump, right? So we all have the lump.
Pretty lumpy.
Pretty lumpy. And as we age, I think that we learn more of that. We learn more about that. But the bottom line is we don't get to practice with a wished-for version of this. We practice with it as it is. And bowing for me is a beautiful, I think this is one of the reasons that form is so important to me in practice, is because we get to see our body in relationship to it over years of practice. So bowing for me is a good example of that. You know, bowing has never been easy for me. And I have back problems and chronic pain and so forth. It's never been easy for me. And recently I had neck surgery. My doctor told me, I said, now, the one thing I want to know is, will I be able to bow? And let me show you this bow, because it's important to me to be able to do this after my surgery. So I'm in with the orthopedic surgeon, and I'm bowing in his office to show him this is what it is. So I want no error. Can I do this afterward? Oh, yes. But don't use your head. My mother would love this, mother. The doctor told me not to use my head. So I had to then really think about, like, okay, I had to relearn how to bow without putting weight on my forehead in the bow. So I had to transfer my weight. If you notice how you bow, you may put your weight on your forehead when you raise your hands. Okay? And I can't do that. anymore. It's dangerous for my neck. So now I have to shift, relearn, reteach myself the body of bowing in this body as it is now, so that I don't put weight on my head. I shifted my weight to my elbows. So, but that meant re-embodying a full bow. So, I cannot be asleep and bow in this body. I cannot bow asleep. Because if I do, I fall. I lose my balance. If I'm not wide awake, I definitely can lose track and not be able to finish the bow. And this has happened to me. So I don't have the luxury of being asleep for bowing, and I'm extremely grateful for that in practice, because every bow is awake, and every bow takes into consideration the minutia of the bow itself, which is the only thing present in that moment. And if I don't give myself completely to that, I won't be able to finish it. And so my body gives me the opportunity to experience this treasure of bowing in this very awake way. And that to me is why Zazen, because each of us practices with this lump of red meat, is why Zazen is so dynamic. And it's so very individual. Every body exists in its shimmering uniqueness. And it requires its particular posture in Zazen. Some of us require props and chairs and cushions and cots and, you know, ways to be in practice. I think when I came here for Sesshin, I brought a ton, it was a cot, but I referred to it as a ton because I was bringing it into so that people who could not sit upright could lie down for Zazen, which included me and other people at the Sesshin. So it's not sleeping, it's Zazen in lying down posture. And there's a huge difference between those two things. Being able to do that reflects, or including that in our practice, for me, it just acknowledges that each of us practices with this lump of red meat. So I can't make assumptions about your lump. All I can do is accommodate it, be prepared for it, what it may need in order to practice. That's all I can do, is be prepared for what it might need to come to practice fully, to bring itself, you, fully to practice. Darlene Cohen said, "No matter what you see or experience, there is nothing beyond your own nose. You can only see your own idea of it. See it new each time. In meditation, when your mind is drawn by something," and we had that this morning in spades, right? A lot of sound outside the Zendo and a lot different sounds in each sitting period. But nevertheless, a lot going on out there. So when your mind is drawn by something, a breathing sound or some smell, find it in your body. Where is it? Your thoughts and emotions are there. So is all you see, hear, and touch. So is all you see, hear, and touch. It's all in your body. So now and then I choose a half hour or an hour or a half day to engage in a practice that Darlene gave me, which she gave many students, and swore to her deathbed that none of us ever did it. And we probably never did it as completely as she did it. But my version of it is that, I am aware, for that period of time, and I have to choose a shorter period of time. Darlene probably did this every day her whole life, but for me, a half hour, some days, or maybe a half day. And that is everything that comes in contact with my skin I am aware of for that period of time, everything. So a bead of sweat rolling down my face is coming in contact with my skin. I can feel it right here. Everything, the air, the warmth, the cold, my hair, not my hair, It used to come in, but not right now. My robes, you know, if you just think about all the things that come into contact with your skin, so you don't have to actively touch it for it to come in contact. You walk by a bush, it contacts your skin. So for some period of time, it takes a great deal of practice and a great deal of presence in the body to really notice the whole body at the same time and everything that comes into contact with it. To notice what you're noticing is all contact of your body, your vessel with anything other than your vessel, or even the contact of your body with itself. And every time I do this, I relearn that the true universal activity is present in all things and in this connection of things. Even the countertop, my underwear, the drop of sweat, each of these connections nourishes me to the extent that I bring myself to it, to the extent that I'm truly present for it. It nourishes me. And so this body-to-body, form-to-body, form-to-form, we could say, practice is it is an intimacy which enlivens the mundane. It makes the mundane rich and fascinating. I find myself when I'm practicing this saying, "What is that? What was that?" Oh, wanting to know more. So it brings up curiosity. It's a creative practice, this body practice, this presence in body. So in my experience, this is the same thing that ritual does in our practice. And in any practice, I was raised Catholic, that did the same thing for me in the Catholic Church as well, the form, the high ritual. It is the effect of practicing forms together, body to body, is that both intimacy and spaciousness are enjoyed. Both closeness and spaciousness are enjoyed simultaneously. And I think that's what I learn when I do this contact practice, is that it's very spacious, actually, when I'm in touch with everything that I come into contact with. It creates a spaciousness of mind that can say, oh, yes, this too. Oh, this too. Not excluding anything and really including everything. Oh, yeah, this too. This is the body too. This is the body too. Everything that touches is body, vessels, all. Yes, this too. So it creates a tremendous spaciousness to be so connected to my body and my activity and my connections with everything else. And I think that's what happens when we practice forms together, when we bow together and we bow to one another and we come in our robes to the Zendo and we enter in a certain way and we walk in a certain way and we respond to bells in a certain way and so on. I think that brings forth this opportunity for form body to form body awakening in the moment, and this intimacy that makes that mundane life of sesshin, of the schedule being the same day in and day out, rich and nuanced and alive. And so even in my own solo body practice, this is revealed. Even in my own self-care, this is revealed. And in my solo practice with the countertop and the microwave and the coffee cup, this is revealed. And certainly in Sangha. I mean, I truly think that we only wake up in Sangha. We need each other to wake up. And for me, these connections, even this little table with its lectern, are all opportunities to awaken. The care we take is really the awakening itself. So I hope that you will all take care of your precious selves, and also that you will take care of each other.